Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. As always, so many people have no idea of the things that have happened or the meaning and importance of what has happened in the past. In the struggles of our whites in our motherland of Europe, there has been intensive competition for thousands of years. Europe is dynamic, and Europeans have experimented with everything. Everything that you need to know, you can learn from Europe. There are very few things that whites outside of Europe can teach Europeans. Probably the area where we can have the best input is with regards to other races who are very different to the European people. But when it comes to how to organize, how to live your life, how to rule your country, how to defend yourself, how to do engineering, how to do science, I want to tell you, everything is in Europe. The Europeans have done the greatest work of all. But there is also a relationship in more modern centuries, in the last 500 years, between the whites who left Europe and the whites who remained in Europe. Because I think that there is very important stuff there that needs to be looked at closely. Now, the purpose of this video is not that it is part of the Gods of War series, but there is an element from the Gods of War that is so important, and it would take us so long to get there, that I decided that I'm gonna quickly do a video to draw your attention to something that's extremely important. Later, you will understand the importance of what I'm going to tell you in this video. There is that video that I did recently where I said, if I were to die tomorrow, what is the last thing I would tell you? And in that video, I was discussing the evolution of the European people as a race, where we've been going for the last 500 years, and where this is heading towards, and why. And in and amongst these changes are things that relate to wars that have been fought in Europe. And I have raised the issue a number of times about the similarities and problems of the achievements of Napoleon and Hitler. That Napoleon and Hitler are the only two white men who have unified Europe for short periods of time for the first time since the Roman Empire. There were others like Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire, where you had somebody trying to mimic the Roman Empire after the Roman Empire had fallen. And they did it under Christianity. But to be honest with you, when you understand the Roman Empire, you will understand why Charlemagne is not that important and he's not that great. And a lot of what happened under Christianity is not that impressive. However, our path back to the Roman Empire and to pagan times starts with the Renaissance and the rediscovery of the Romans and the Greeks, because as a people, we totally forgot that we had even had those civilizations and empires. It's actually a hideous, horrific thing that happened to us. It is the height of darkness and stupidity that descended on us for 1,000 years on all white people. It actually gives me the creeps when I think about it. And I must tell you that with liberalism and racial equality, Jews are taking us back to an age of extreme darkness, exactly like that one that we experienced for 1,000 years. Jews are taking us back into darkness and stupidity and the foolishness that occurs when you forget reality and you forget the true lessons of your history. I cannot impress enough upon you the threat that liberalism and racial equality poses to European people as a race. And to think that there is a group of people with the utter impudence to even attempt to do this, namely the Jews. This is an extremely creepy, bizarre thing. It's very weird, and it's got to do with our strange relationship with this bunch of creeps and scum. Hitler was bringing us into the light of the truth and reality, and Jews are trying their damnedest to ram us back into stupidity and retardation. There's an American I know who was a close supporter of Tom Metzger, and this guy came up with the term myth-tardation, and that is a very good way to look at it, that Jews are thrusting a new myth upon us, and it's a myth that's going to retard us. So the Renaissance brought us knowledge. Specifically and most importantly, it brought us science that we had forgotten. But then there also came other things, all kinds of history of thought, philosophy, politics, all kinds of other thinking that whites had engaged in the time of the Romans and the Greeks. And the Romans and the Greeks wrote down their history, and we have hundreds and hundreds of years of history from the Romans and the Greeks that explained to us various things that they tried, various things that happened, and there's so much that you can learn from that history. This Roman stuff and Greek stuff is often referred to as the classics. Now, hidden in those classics are all kinds of values and thoughts, and these things were studied not just by intellectuals, but also by military people and kings in Europe. So when we look at Napoleon and Hitler, there's a very interesting similarity between the two of them. It is that both of them were bookworms. Both of them studied history intensely. And these guys read and read and read and absorbed and processed history. But among the history that blew their minds was the history of Rome. Now, the founding fathers of America also studied the classics. They also studied the Romans and the Greeks. And in some cases, they even learned Latin or Greek and could read it in its original languages. So the founding fathers of America also were very impressed with the Romans. And modern America is meant to be a better Rome. Now, by the time that Hitler lived, he also had the benefit of science that had advanced in the years since after Napoleon. So there's a lot of science that Hitler had access to that Napoleon did not have access to. But if you look at the things that Hitler did, Hitler was borrowing heavily from the Romans, even though, because the Germans were descended from the Germanic tribes, they obviously had to take their own ancestors seriously, and they had to look up to them, but they also could not miss out on the awesomeness of the Roman Empire. So in Hitler's Germany, you will see architecture that's Roman architecture. You'll see the Roman eagle that the Roman army used, etc., etc. When you study European history, you can't just stick with one tribe or one nation, because every nation or every tribe of whites go through their periods of ups and downs. And you'll find that at various points, excellence and genius comes to one group of Europeans more than to anyone else at the same time. And then you have different European nations that explode in ability, creativity, energy, etc. Everybody goes through it. The French go through it. The British go through it. The Russians go through it. You'll see even tiny little countries in Europe that you almost ignore these days. Tiny little countries, Bulgaria and other places. You'll see that everybody has their moment of greatness and awesomeness. The Spanish, the Italians, the Portuguese, the Poles, it goes on and on. But the Romans are special. They are very special, and that's why we're going to look at them closely in a number of ways. One of the things that also changed in Europe as a result of the Renaissance is warfare. Because the Romans and the Greeks were very warlike whites in their own right. They weren't warlike because they were lunatic nuts. If some Jew or liberal has to write about them, they'll want to pretend that they were demented in some way. That's not the case. They were warlike simply due to plain, pure logic and experience. And this is true for all whites. It is that when you face the problems of life, eventually you learn certain things and you realize certain things. And there comes a time where you realize you have to defend yourself or you have to go and crush somebody else. So European war also changes due to many things that come from the Romans and the Greeks. And then you start seeing something that you haven't seen for a long time. You see European armies that are totally kick-ass. You get armies like Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden. Now the Swedes had several Gustavus Adolphuses. I'm not sure which one it is. It might have been the second one. But then along come others like Frederick the Great. And of all of Hitler's heroes, Frederick the Great is his greatest hero. But there's another guy who also has Frederick the Great as one of his heroes, and that is Napoleon. Frederick the Great is also well-educated, well-read, but in his age, Napoleon is a man who studies the classics extremely intensely, and he truly grasps the Romans and the Greeks totally. So although he's a Christian, he imbibes those values from those pre-Christian times, and he sucks them up intensely. There is one difference that takes place that is different between the European geniuses of more modern times versus the Romans. And it is a strange thing. It is that the Romans were very warlike and very successful at warfare. But the Romans did not have lots of great generals. This may seem kind of strange and weird, but the Romans actually didn't have the great generals and commanders that we've had in modern times. What the Romans had instead was a culture at the common man's level that enabled them to function extremely well in war. So it may strike you as strange that the Roman army, which was insanely successful, was not led with the same kind of genius as armies of modern times. Yet, that army was still extremely successful. I'm not saying that they were badly led. I'm just saying that there weren't many truly incredible generals. So what you get that's a difference between modern times and the Roman and Greek times is that common men, common white men, are not anywhere closely as militarized as the Romans. That the average white male doesn't have a fraction of the militarization of the Romans. But when we do have guys who are professionals in the military, then among them we get some geniuses who pop out as leaders. But don't let me leave you with the impression that Roman military leaders were garbage. They just didn't stand out as greatly. One could say that even their garbage, even the average for the Romans, would still be very good by our standards. So I'm not going to delve too much into the Romans further here in comparing them with the modern armies, but I'm just trying to sketch something that you can grasp without making it too confusing. As a general comment, I want to impress upon you that hardship, trouble, strife, etc., always leads to innovation. There are lots of people, especially Christians, I note, who are constantly complaining about the need for world peace. There must be peace. We need peace. Why isn't there peace? We must strive for peace. If we don't have peace, we need to try harder to have more peace, etc. This is really quite childish thinking, and it doesn't actually match reality. The reality of life is that life is filled with competition, and life is filled with people who want power, who want their way. This is natural. It's the same as the animal world. It's just that it happens among higher animals, and we are the highest animal on this planet. And you cannot escape conflict and trouble. There are many, many, many reasons why you cannot escape conflict and trouble. It has to do with human dynamics. It's got to do with population movement. It's got to do with economics. It's got to do with all kinds of things. So even as people are living peacefully and they're working away, there are all kinds of weird imbalances that are building up in societies, and sooner or later people start clashing with each other, even white people. So let us turn to Napoleon and why I'm making this video about Napoleon and what is special about Napoleon. As I've said, Napoleon studied the classics tremendously. He studied all history, like Hitler. He read and studied widely. But Napoleon especially had a liking for the classics, the Romans and the Greeks. And he read and pondered these things over and over again. In some of my reading of Napoleon's memoirs, memoirs written by the French rather than stuff written by the enemies of the French, it is interesting to see how on a daily basis these people who were with Napoleon when he was in exile, how they would every day take some book and somebody would read passages or pages from a book, and then they would sit around and actually discuss it and debate it. That was their form of entertainment, and their entertainment was to sharpen their minds, to analyze daily, continuously. It was almost like gym, but gym for your brains. And if you actually dig into European history, you'll see how much thought white men put into things. White men could think very, very, very deeply. And this is long before computers and everything. They sharpened their minds to levels that are amazing. Now, European warfare has gone through various cycles, and warfare goes through cycles. And even right now, we are in a cycle. And I notice when I talk to people that people misunderstand or miss out on certain things, things that are very important. And there is a belief, for example, that warfare at this point in time has attained a certain level of greatness whereby modern professional armies cannot be defeated, that modern professional Western armies can't be defeated by the masses. In our history, our people have overthrown leaders whom they didn't like. It's been done many times. In fact, the history of the Roman Empire and even something like the French Revolution have lots of things in common. Even though they are democracies, there are times when the people overthrow their leaders, when a country goes into civil war. Even the Roman Empire experienced civil wars that raged across the Roman Empire. And then one faction or another takes control of Rome. So even though they had democracy and all that, there were times when those things broke down and then they waged war against each other. Mostly these things are done by elites who fight each other. So one elite fights another elite and the people join either side and somebody comes out victorious. Now, in the cycles of wars, warfare changed after the fall of the Roman Empire. For a long period of time, you had kings ruling Europe. But these kings who totally ruled and owned their own countries, those kings actually had quite small armies. Their armies were small and highly professional. These armies were small and expensive. At all ages in history, right into the most ancient times, military weapons are always extremely expensive. You are always pushing the bounds of technology. Military weaponry 3,000 years ago was hideously expensive in the same way that it is today. Nothing changes. War is always the most expensive thing that you can do. It's insanely expensive, and it always has been. So in the Christian age, you had lots of these kings who had small armies. And when they went to war, the vast mass of people were just workers and they just carried on living their lives normally because only professionals went and fought, and the king himself had limitations in how many people he could bring into his army. Whereas if you go back to the time of the Roman armies were much bigger compared to the size of the population. The Romans could raise big armies of people when they needed to. They would raise these armies either for campaigns to go and fight someone elsewhere, or in an emergency, they are being invaded, somebody's busy conquering their territory, and they need armies immediately. Maybe their armies have already been defeated in battle and they need more troops and they raise them quickly. The Romans had democracy of a kind, But the Roman Empire wasn't run by a king. It was a state of the people. And the Romans had a much bigger vested interest in their society. Whereas in Christian Europe, you had kings and royal families that passed on power to their children. So you had a hereditary royal family who rule a country. And so the king dies and the prince takes over, and so it carries on. It gets more complicated than that. And it's actually quite a fascinating thing, the way the European royal families developed and how it functioned as the centuries went by. They became the elite of Europe. And they weren't necessarily bad people, I must tell you. There are lots of those royal families who, if you had to compare them with the modern liberal elite of the Western world today, I would tell you there is no comparison. Those people had probably higher morals and cared more for their own people than the garbage, the utter garbage that ruled the Western world today. Then came the French Revolution. I'm not going to go into the reasons and causes and the roles played by Jews. I just want to focus on the military side of things. So the French Revolution comes, and suddenly there is this uprising of the masses of the whites who are now going to destroy their ruling monarchy, their elite. And it goes through all kinds of nasty, weird stuff. It's almost like a communist revolution. There's all kinds of nasty things, including lots of executions, beheadings. It's a nasty thing. But it is an overthrow of the elite, and it is power to the people. And this event is so shocking in Europe that all the other monarchs see this, and they realize that this thing could spread and it could destroy all of them. So the situation that develops in France is that you've got these whites who are revolutionaries. They've overthrown their monarchy. They've seized control of the government and the military, and they've declared themselves a republic or whatever, and they are going to rule themselves now. So what happens is that they now come into conflict with other European states and European empires, and the next thing you know is that these other states and empires run by kings, they send in their troops to invade France and to crush these revolutionaries and to put the monarchy back in power, the Bourbons specifically. And it is in this scenario that Napoleon starts rising. Napoleon is a Corsican. He's actually of Italian descent. His home language really is Italian, actually. So Napoleon comes from this little island, but his parents sent him to military school in France. And he did well at military school, and he particularly focused on artillery. Artillery in his day was the most technical and powerful military weapon. However, interestingly, even though it's 200 years later, artillery is still a very, very critical force on the battlefield. And it was so even in World War I, even in World War II. The big guns still have a big role to play in modern warfare, even today. But Napoleon specialized in artillery, and so he's just a youngster who's been in military school, and he's growing up, and now all this fighting is coming about, and he's starting to get involved in various things, and all he's doing is he's just moving around and looking for his opportunities, and he's on the side of the people simply because he's among them, even though his family is actually somewhat upper class, actually. So now France is at war. But France is a big country in Europe, and it packs a punch. It has always packed a punch. Unlike the Germans, the French united a long time ago and got a big chunk of territory, and they've always been a big player in Europe. Whereas the Germans were very divided for very long periods of time, and the Germans were very individualistic and very divided to insane levels, with teeny-weeny little kingdoms dotted all over the show. So the French find themselves at war with lots of countries, and they are now trying to defend themselves, and they're fighting back as best they can. But they face serious existential threats. And now, in order to defend themselves, they have to raise armies themselves. And they also now, somewhat like the Romans, they start taking an interest in their own affairs, and they raise their armies and they go and they fight. But they're not doing that well. They get bashed quite badly at times, and they are living on the edge. Anyhow, Napoleon gets involved in all these things, and as he rises up through the ranks, which goes quite quickly, as he rises up through the ranks, eventually by the age of about 26, he's already a general in command of an army, a very poverty-stricken army, I might add. So Napoleon now goes and fights, and as he fights, he's amazingly successful, and they take notice of his abilities, and so he rises and he deals with this government that is now in charge, and he also comes up with his own ideas of places they need to go, things they need to attack, etc., etc. And he becomes a total hero, and eventually he ends up becoming the single ruler of France. But he becomes the ruler on the basis of one skill only: his ability to command armies and to fight. He eventually is even crowned as emperor, and he attains this all through his military skill alone. And the people are behind him because he is the key hero who is keeping France alive, this rebellious France alive. Now the British and the Russians and others are all working together to destroy this troublesome threat of Napoleon and the French. So these French, just like the Germans were to find later, these French are in a state of war, and these other European nations are trying to crush them. The British play a key role in constantly trying to destroy the French. Even when the French beat everybody who fights them, the British always come back and gather together new enemies for France, and then everybody goes to war against France again. These are known as the coalitions. It's the same thing as the quotes allies against the Germans. It's just that they were called the coalitions in that time. And the British are the key troublemakers in all of this, because the British have got a long-term goal to always see to it that Europe remains divided. They don't want one country to dominate Europe. This is exactly the same stuff that they were doing when Germany was united, World War I, World War II. Those are the same situations. It's the same game. It's to break German power so that Germany does not dominate Europe. But in the time of Napoleon, It was to break French power so that these anti-monarchist French revolutionaries not only have a viable state, but they can actually trigger new revolutions that can overthrow the monarchies. So Napoleon finds himself constantly at war under serious threat from first-class European states, and they are working to physically destroy the French. And they come with professional armies, and they come to invade or destroy or drive out the French from wherever they are. And these wars become big. And as time goes by, multiple countries and multiple empires actually bring their troops together to fight the French. And the French have got to fight all these big players with professional armies and large resources. And how do the French do it? And this is where Napoleon changes warfare. Napoleon was probably more of a militarist than even Hitler. And as I was going through some of his memoirs, he's very proud of it. He's thinking totally in military terms. And he's got enemies everywhere. And he's got enemies on land, he's got enemies at sea, he's got serious problems. But Napoleon is a god of war. And he understands military stuff backwards. So Napoleon looks at all his resources and he starts working out ways to enable the French to try and fight and defeat these well-equipped professional armies that are coming from strong states that are trying to destroy them. And the way that he does it is that he looks at his resources of men and material, and he starts developing a system that can work. Basically, what he does is, because he's an expert in artillery, he knows artillery backwards, and he can do amazing things with artillery. If he can get enough artillery, he can change battles. But you cannot fight a battle with just artillery. You also need troops. Infantry are the most important troops, and you need them in number. And he's up against big forces. So what Napoleon does is he actually counts how many people are in the country. Napoleon is the first ruler who invents the modern census. He goes and he counts how many men are there in the country, how many males are there, and how old are they. And he groups them by age, and he calls them up. Napoleon is the inventor of the census. Napoleon is the inventor of conscription. Even though the French men are much more willing to fight for their republic than, let's say, the Austrians are to fight for the Austrian emperor, the fact of the matter is that there are still men who are not fighting for France, who could fight for France. So Napoleon invents conscription to see to it that all men do their duty for the nation. So he's got manpower. Now Napoleon taps into the manpower of France. He taps into the manpower scientifically. He has the ability to count and record them, and he can call them up. And remember, this is 200 years ago, hey? Before computers, before all these other modern doodads, the French, by hand methods, were pulling off amazing feats of administration. Europeans have been doing excellent administration for thousands of years, actually, for well over 2,000 years. Nowadays, here in Africa, blacks can only do it with computers, and even then, they can't do it well. Europeans were doing this all by hand for the last 2,500 years. So Napoleon calls up chunks of men, big groups of men of the same age. He calls them up and he starts training them. But he's up against professional armies. These are professional troops. There are guys in there who've been in the army for much of their lives. He's up against the best of the best. So what Napoleon does is he cannot churn out the kind of professional troops that all these other states have. So he basically invents a type of militia. And he can call up men and he can train them for a short period of time, arm them, and send them straight into battle. He trains the men and he also develops the tactics that allow these men who are not professionals, who are still not battle-hardened, so that they can go into battle and face real professionals. He develops specific tactics. For example, if you look on the image on the screen in front of you, in the bottom left, you'll see a painting of a Napoleonic battle. Just be aware of one thing about all these paintings. These painters are painting on a canvas and they have to fit all their action into that canvas. So the things they are painting are much more cramped than it was in real life. Just be aware of that. Though the troops are packed together tightly, the battles are fought over quite large distances. But in that painting, if you look in the distance, in the top left of that painting, you'll see the smoke from the cannon fire. But you'll see, for example, what appear to be lines of troops. If you look in the top right, you'll see a photo of reenactors, and you'll see these reenactors marching in a column. So the professional armies had the skills and the discipline to mostly fight efficiently as lines. But the French, especially when they are untrained, they struggle to fight against professional troops in that way. And Napoleon focused a lot of his stuff on columns of men, more like those guys who are marching along the roads. So his less experienced troops, but he has masses of troops, his less experienced troops fight somewhat differently. And they fight differently also because not only are they not that good, but they can also scare easily and they can run away. And one of the things that Napoleon does constantly in his wars is whenever he assesses an enemy army that's been built up to fight him, he doesn't have, like I say, the quality of the enemy army. But what he does try to do is he tries to raise as many troops as he can to almost match them in numbers. So he tries to get the numbers more or less balanced. Even though he doesn't have all the quality, he tries to get the numbers closer so that they don't outnumber him too much. So he quickly raises an army, quickly gives them some basic training, and he develops tactics, and those troops learn certain ways of fighting, that they can be quickly taught and they can be quickly armed and off they go. And then his final thing, the way that he's going to bust the enemy, is he sees to it that he gets lots of artillery. He gathers every freaking piece of artillery that he can. And his tactics on the battlefield are to use those lowly trained masses of men along with his masses of artillery, but very carefully placed, and using the artillery and that sort of militia type army of his, he throws them at the enemy and he controls the battle and he manages to defeat the professional armies. So with a lesser army that is almost nothing more than a militia type army with a little bit of military training, he actually can fight an army that is fully professional, properly equipped, and he can defeat them. And he does it again and again and again. And then, of course, there are professional troops in his army, and there are troops that have got certain special abilities, and he uses them in key ways. He's got cavalry, he's got grenadiers, he's got guards, and he uses them for certain other heavy stuff or special stuff. But the mass of his troops are these almost militia types. And Napoleon fights so many battles and he refines his techniques to such a degree that eventually his enemies have to start learning from him and they have to develop counter tactics against him. Now, eventually, Napoleon is overthrown, the French are crushed, just like the Germans, they eventually get worn out and they are eventually crushed. But unlike the Germans, the French fight almost non-stop. I'm not joking with you. The French fight almost non-stop for about 20 years. It's actually amazing the amount of wars the French have to fight. After Napoleon is now exiled and he dies a short while later, I'm absolutely convinced he was poisoned by the British. In the decades that follow, military scholars begin to study Napoleon's methods. They try to figure out what is the secret of Napoleon's success. How did he manage to beat all these other armies? And as time goes by, military scholars start looking at his methods and start learning lessons from them. And after Napoleon is dead, for about the next 100 years, all Western armies actually fight using lessons gained from Napoleon. And there are lessons from Napoleon that are used to this day, conscription being one example, and the census being another. But on the actual battlefield, the generals have refined and learned methods from the way that Napoleon used cavalry, the way he used his infantry, the way he used his artillery. They took all those lessons to heart, and all those lessons were used right up until World War I. It is only after World War I when the aircraft and the tank start coming into play that there are more changes to the way that armies fight. But from the time of Napoleon until about World War I, armies were working almost 100% on the Napoleon formula. And finally, Napoleon may have a unique achievement. I need to look a bit more closely at this, but I've come across mention of this by academics on more than one occasion now. Napoleon's France was under such immense pressure militarily, and Napoleon had to draw on his reservoir of white manpower to such a degree that Napoleon might be the only ruler since the Romans. He might be the only ruler, European ruler, since the Romans who had to draw on vast quantities of manpower, possibly to the extent of calling up as much as 20% of the male population for a war immediately. He might be the only one who calls up 20% of the male population at a time when he's under extreme stress. The last time that whites were that militarized was under the Roman Empire. Napoleon was so good with his French army that the enemy generals, despite all their resources, etc., and the enemy states, had to do all kinds of weird things in order to try to reduce his effectiveness. One of the first things that generals did, for example, and as far as I know, I think this is one of the very few times in history this was ever done. The only other time it was done was the Romans when they fought Hannibal, because Hannibal was also an excellent white military leader, is that the generals who were fighting against Napoleon, if they knew that Napoleon commanded a certain army and that his lesser generals and marshals were commanding other troops, they would actually attack the other armies and try to avoid fighting Napoleon's army, because they knew that if they fought Napoleon himself, that he'd clobber them. That Napoleon himself was so good that no matter what situation they put him in, he would manage to beat them. So one of the ways they started to defeat the French was by fighting the generals as long as they weren't Napoleon. So if they saw another one of Napoleon's marshals commanding an army, then they rather attack that army rather than fight Napoleon himself. The other thing was the British started guerrilla warfare in the Iberian Peninsula, in Portugal and Spain, and they fought a long guerrilla war against the French there. And then the French also fought in Russia. But the French fought a hell of a lot, and they won a hell of a lot. Also, by the time that Napoleon finally stepped down from power twice, because he actually stepped down from power twice, once in 1814 he abdicated, then he came back in 1815 and quickly launched a counterattack, seized France, launched a counterattack, and lost at Waterloo. On both those occasions, Napoleon was actually not yet fully defeated, nor were the French actually finished. In 1815, when Napoleon lost at Waterloo, there was another battle after Waterloo, not fought by Napoleon, but fought by another general, and the French won that battle. So the French still won a proper full-scale battle after Waterloo. Furthermore, even though France was divided, there were lots of people who still wanted Napoleon to fight. But Napoleon actually did not want a civil war among French. Napoleon did not want a brother war. He did not want Frenchmen killing other Frenchmen. He rather stepped down than have Frenchmen killing other Frenchmen. He was by no means actually finished. And the French were not fully defeated yet. They still had a lot of military facilities. Whereas under Hitler, the Germans fought until there was nothing left. The French actually still had potential military power, both in terms of men and in terms of actual physical equipment. They still had large amounts of stuff right at the end. So you can understand why Napoleon was poisoned by the British, because, and I'm convinced that the British poisoned him, because he was the most dangerous man on the planet. And even when he went into exile, there were people willing to come and do, let's call it, jail time with Napoleon. There was no shortage of generals and officers and others who willingly went with Napoleon wherever he went, even if it was let's call it to jail, to exile. They had no problem going with him. Wherever he went, they were happy to follow with him. That was the kind of loyalty that he commanded, loyalty and respect that Napoleon commanded right to the end of his life. But, returning to the key lesson, Napoleon and the French invented and refined a method of massed warfare whereby they could take on and destroy professional armies, because professional armies are always smaller than the vast mass of the population of the people. And that is true right to this day. The real lesson of Roman democracy and French democracy is that the mass of whites can overthrow whoever rules them, as long as they've got access to weapons. That is why the founding fathers of America insisted that the common man be armed, so that the whites of America can at any time overthrow whoever rules them. But the founding fathers of America based their thinking on the Romans, who were a very militarized people. But Napoleon is the most modern proof of the power of masses of whites, even if they're badly trained, but they have the will and determination to fight. Napoleon is one of the best examples of masses of whites and what they can do. The next best example is the Wehrmacht, Hitler's Wehrmacht. The difference is that Hitler managed to train his men to higher levels. But I don't think that Hitler was ever able to gather true masses of men to the same degree as Napoleon. That is why I'm mentioning that I think, according to scholars, and I've come across this twice, that Napoleon, I think, is the only leader of modern ages who managed to gather 20% of the male population to fight at a time, on the rare occasions that he needed to go that far. So I think the number is 20% of the male population. I know that as a rule in modern warfare, in World War II, etc., that they have raised armies that are equal to about 10% of the full population, which means men and women. But the difference there is that the percentage of the army that are combatants is much less. I think in World War II, only about 60% or 65 to 70% at the most of the army were actually involved in actual fighting. There was 30% that are doing the logistics and the other things. Nowadays, the logistics and those things are handled by about 70% of the army. The vast majority of the military is busy with logistics and stuff like that. The actual percentage of combatants is only about 30% of the actual modern militaries. So you need to keep in mind how many troops are actually deployed in battle actually. And Napoleon and the Romans may hold the all-time record of militarization of whites, with the Wehrmacht being second. So keep these things in mind, because this is also what the founding fathers of America had in mind. They based their thinking on the Roman model. Napoleon lived on the Roman model as well, and he took it as far as it could go. And he was able to fight virtually everybody in Europe, and on more than one occasion he would fight more than one country at the same time. So in this modern age that we live in now, where people say, oh no, it's so different, blah, 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 I reckon that we are back to the age of kings. We are back to the age of kings, small professional armies that fight for whoever the scumbags are who are in power. But never forget that there is a mass of white men that can be organized, and it's simply a case of working out the methods and the tactics that will work in the modern age. And even Hitler was thinking in terms of armies of the people. And we should be thinking in terms of armies of the white people. That is how the Romans thought, and we're going to visit the Romans, and you'll see how awesome they are. But don't ever believe that the mass of whites can be enslaved by some scumbags whom they hate. When white people are motivated and organized properly, they pack an insane punch. And the French, the Germans, the Romans, these will give you examples of the kind of punch that whites can pack. But I want to specifically discuss the Romans because, believe it or not, as good as Napoleon was, as good as the Germans were, the Romans were even more amazing. I know you may think that is almost impossible to believe, but I'll show you some things about the Romans and why everybody turns back to the Romans. But the notion that white people are a bunch of wusses, white people are a bunch of useless fools, that's just garbage. And about these images that you have here, where you see these armies, the Roman legion down there on the bottom right, the formations in the time of the Napoleonic Wars, all of these things are not done for the sake of fashion. Warfare is totally about reality. Soldiers only do things based on what is necessary and what works. All of European history, all of white history, is based on reality. So everything that you see there, the way those troops are, the way they are dressed, the formations they use, the methods they use, everything that's in there has a very real and good reason for being that way. It's not because someone just did it like that, because they liked it that way, etc. It's because those systems of organization of white men as fighting forces worked. It worked. And they packed insane amounts of punch. The white man is never finished as long as he's got a will to fight. I will leave you with two quotes from Napoleon. The one quote is, "If you are afraid and still go forward, you are brave." Because in warfare, everybody is afraid. Everyone is afraid. Even professional men become afraid. But finally, and most importantly, is this one from Napoleon where he says, "The army is the true nobility of our country." The army is the true nobility of our country. All these other scumbags and business people, these are the clowns, these are the garbage. It is the army that actually is the most honorable thing and the best thing that any country has. The notion that whites are a bunch of weaklings who have to live in eternal peace because we can't handle a little bit of violence, it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit. And another thing, even when the Romans were heavily militarized, even when the French were heavily militarized, you will never see that the Romans or the French were running out of people. They weren't running out of men. There was a healthy birth rate. They were having lots of kids. And I know that many of you think that, oh, the Chinese, the Indians, the blacks, they are going to overwhelm us. They're going to run over us. No. The white man packs a mean punch. When he's organized and he knows his stuff and he's got his system in place, he's got his system and methods in place, he knows how to do it, and he's properly led, the white man packs a punch like you cannot believe. The white man is not finished. Don't you believe that for 1 second. And even in this quote's modern age, all the old things still apply. You can choose who you want to fight for. You have certain things you can choose in life. So I thought I'd just show you at a high level why Napoleon is a god of war. But there's more, even more, about Napoleon and others, and I will do that in a proper series. And you will understand why white men pack real punches and are not to be toyed with. So it's not a case of, oh, don't make the little black boy angry. No, don't make the white male angry, or the white male will come and he'll fix your ass.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.